Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin on this 4th of July, as we celebrate American democracy, with the question of how much of a democracy we still are, and to what extent have we become a plutocracy, given that just two plutocrats, the Koch brothers, have essentially bought the U.S. Congress along with the presidency, which are both enacting the Koch's agenda at the expense of the American people. Jeffrey Winters, a professor of political science at Northwestern University, where he specializes in oligarchs and elites spanning a range of historical and contemporary cases from ancient Athens and Rome to Indonesia, Russia, and the United States, joins us. He's the author of Oligarchy, and we will discuss how the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision has turned our political system into a money competition in which the race goes to the richest donor who can buy the most politicians, which is exactly what the Koch brothers and their network have done. Then we'll explore further the question of whether or not we are still a democracy or have become a plutocracy with Robert Johnson, the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, who served as chief economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. He joins us to discuss how the plutocrats succeeded in having one of their own, Donald Trump, barely win the presidency, running as a populist against the moneyed establishment, and how now Trump and the Congress elected by the Koch brothers' network are now rewarding their donors with tax cuts for the rich, opening up offshore drilling, bringing back coal, turning on the tar sands pipeline, crippling the EPA, and reversing U.S. leadership on climate change. And joining us now on this 4th of July is Jeffrey Winters, a professor of political science at Northwestern University, where he specializes in oligarchs and elites, spanning a range of historical and contemporary cases, including ancient Athens and Rome, medieval Europe and the United States, as well as Indonesia, Singapore, and the Philippines. He's also studied state-to-state capital relations, capital mobility, and the structural power of investors, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, and the World Bank, human rights, authoritarianism, and democratic transition in post-colonial states. He's the author of Oligarchy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeffrey Winters.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to talk to you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey. And I take it that the United States, I mean, let's start with this question on this day where we're celebrating American democracy and the founding of this country. Are we still a democracy, or have we become a plutocracy, or are we in danger of becoming a plutocracy?
Well, it's an important question to ask on this day, and the answer is not an easy one. But I would say there's no doubt that Americans enjoy tremendous freedoms, to be able to organize, participate, freedom of speech. All of those are core elements of democracy, and those are very important. And although they've been eroded somewhat, I think we can argue that they're still in place. But the other part of democracy is the question of who wins the battles in struggles over fundamental issues in society. And we can simplify it by simply saying, who gets what? Who does government serve? Who does society serve? And in that battle, it's a very long struggle that goes all the way back to the founding of the country. And really, we've had a struggle between the few and the many. And what is it that divides the few and the many? Well, there is very concentrated wealth in very few hands in the United States. By some recent estimates, less than 20 people in the United States equal the wealth of the entire bottom half of the population, 152 million people. So on the one hand, concentrated wealth in the hands of the few, and then large numbers of people who have relatively small wealth. The average savings for the bottom 50% of the United States is $400 per person. So we're talking about a question of who is the system going to benefit? Are policies, are democratic policies going to be put in place that are increasing the living standard of the average American, or is concentration accelerating at the top? And so it's a long, circuitous answer, but I would say we have both oligarchy and democracy in the United States, but the oligarchs are increasingly winning.
Well, could you make the case, though, that we do have a plutocratic government in the sense that it looks as though two plutocrats, the Koch brothers, have set up a network. They put up, I think, a couple of hundred million of their own money, which is chump change to them. But they've organized a network, and they've got various front groups that operate in this arena where they actually concentrate a lot on local government, state governments, which they've had a tremendous influence on. They've, with through their group ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, they've been able to, you know, these poorly staffed Republican lawmakers in all of these states basically have, you know, no resources, etc., and the Koch brothers provide them with all kinds of prepackaged legislation, etc. They're very aggressive in getting the Republican majority through gerrymandering in 2010, and we know that that's led to the Republican domination of the House, which is going to be hard for the Democrats to break. But now in the last cycle, they distanced themselves from Trump to some extent. Well, I think a lot of that was theatrical. They got their guy Pence on as the vice president, and they put a lot of money into House races. They raised about $800 million. They tried to raise a billion, but I think they raised something over $800 million. And so many of the House members in the Republican Party owe their positions to the Koch brothers and to these various groups that they operate under, Freedom Partners and these other euphemisms that they have. So is that the case? I mean, because I'm trying to figure out what's the agenda that's been passed so far by the House. It seems to go against the American people. They're having a hard time selling it, particularly the health care change, which is really a tax cut. Everything they've done seems to be pure Koch brothers agenda, which is, you know, offshore, opening up offshore drilling, turning on the tar sands pipeline, tax cuts for the rich in terms of this bogus health care reform and repeal, crippling the EPA, reversing U.S. leadership on climate change, bringing back coal, et cetera, et cetera. That's all looks like the Koch brothers agenda. And so could we be at a point where literally two plutocrats bought the American government?
Well, I would say the short answer is I don't know if they've bought the whole thing, but they certainly are influential in it at a scale that is all out of proportion. So what they've essentially been able to do is leverage. So let me back up. So you mentioned that they themselves have probably invested somewhere in the $200 to $250 million level, and that's at the federal, state, and local level. This is a full court press of wealth power, okay? And what they do by leveraging that is the Koch brothers are just two people, but they represent a stratum of people in the United States who have the same interest that they have. We're talking about billionaires and multi-centi millionaires, people who have hundreds of millions of dollars, and each of those people operating separately actually have a lot of power and a lot of impact. But what the Koch brothers offer is an opportunity to pool the resources together of people like them and leverage it and coordinate it in a way that maximizes the impact of wealth power on a range of kind of things like you've just described. So if we back up and ask the prior question, what's left of democracy if this is what's fueling and funding it? On one side of the ledger, one kind of power in the United States is participation power. Think of that as the kind of power the average citizen has. And what does that amount to? Well, every 2 or 4 years, you get to go to the polls and you get to cast a vote. Some people, participation power means they join organizations. Some people, it means that they go to demonstrations and marches, or they write letters and call up their representatives. All of these are ways that people can participate. And there's actually a money power dimension for really small average citizens. There's an organization that is trying to compete with the Koch brothers. It's called Act Blue. And this is the kind of you know, the average donation made to Act Blue is $31, which is pretty close to Bernie Sanders' average $27. $31 per donor. Now, think about this. In order for Act Blue to raise as much money as the Koch brothers, using their wealth, power, and their network, were able to raise on the other side of the ledger, because they don't have many people. They can't win by numbers of people. So they can only win by the wealth power they're able to accumulate. So how many people need to donate to Act Blue to equal Koch Brothers' network of 300 to 400 billionaires and millionaires that they pull together? And the answer is it takes 31 million Americans donating to Act Blue to equal the same amount that the Koch brothers brought to bear in the 2016 election cycle at all levels. What does this mean? It means that the wealth power of each individual Koch brother and the network they leverage is 100,000 times that of an ordinary American citizen. So you've got one person, one vote, but on the money power side of the ledger, it's an unfair game of 100,000 to one. And now, if I can connect this to what you said about the agenda, what is it that the Koch brothers and their network of people, what do they fundamentally want? You can sum it up as simply one thing. They are attacking government. They don't want government. And you may say, what's so awful about government? Why in the world would they target government at all levels? And the answer is, governments are able to tax. And governments are able to spend tax money on programs for people who are struggling to make it and to survive. And the Koch brothers and their friends don't like that. They have demonized the government, and this has gone on for decades, since Reagan forward. The core Republican agenda is to demonize government, because government is the only thing that can reduce their profits and redistribute to those and open up public space opportunities for those who can't make it. And so if you look down the agenda of the Koch brothers and what they've actually pushed through their proxies, in the White House and in the Congress and at the state level, they want a reduction of taxes. Why? That lets them keep more of their money and accumulate faster. They want to attack the public education system. Why? Because they send their kids to private schools and they don't want to pay taxes for anything that has public in front of it. And they attack the Obamacare Affordable Care Act because it means it's a massive tax boondoggle for them. To pay for Obamacare, which is helping people get access to health care who couldn't pay for it before, a tax was placed on the very wealthiest people in the United States. Trump and the people that he has in the Senate and in the House, funded by Koch's network, are going to reduce those taxes and hand $500 billion back to people who already are sitting on more money than can be spent across 10 generations. So this is the agenda. The agenda is a simple ideology. Government is the enemy. Why? Because government can actually help the many and make the wealthy foot at least part of the bill. And that's what they fight against.
So how did this happen, though? We've always had oligarchs. Mm-hmm. We've already had a Gilded Age, and now we have a second Gilded Age.
Yep.
My sense is that what's enabled this, the buying of our politics wholesale by a handful of plutocrats, is the Supreme Court Citizens United decision, which has turned our political system into a money competition in which the race goes to the richest donor who can buy the most politicians, and that's exactly what the Koch brothers and their network have done.
Well, so you've hit on something. Again, if we think of the battle as fundamentally between wealth power, and that means the freedom to be able in an unrestricted way to use your wealth in the political process. That means paying for candidates, paying for their campaigns, all that stuff. If you think about that as how do you maximize the impact of wealth power in the system, Anybody who tries to put in campaign finance reform, anybody who tries to limit the use of money in the system is the enemy. And so there is nothing that oligarchs and plutocrats have fought harder to do than to open up the use of money power in the system. So that is target number one, to make the spending of money equal to freedom of speech and casting a vote. But they're casting a money vote, okay? But there's another side of the ledger. So I said one side of the democratic struggle or the political struggle is money power. The other one is participation power. What do the people have on their side of the ledger? Well, they clearly don't have money. Or if they do, it's in such small pockets that you need so many people donating at once to balance what these small number of people are spending. Now, that's very hard to do. So the organization is what works on behalf of the many. And if you look over the last century, here's what basically has happened. The capacity of workers to organize in unions and in an organized labor. There was a point at which in U.S. history, not too many decades ago, where there was great strength in that organization. And by the way, one of the biggest targets of Trump spending at the state level and at all levels is against unions and against labor, because they know that organized labor and unions are very effective when they're working well. And so they work at the state level to pass legislation that undermines unions and undermines the power of the many. So when people have made gains over the last century, it's been because they've been well organized. And frankly, when Americans are well organized, it is not necessarily everything going to the oligarchs. So during key decades in the 20th century, for example, oligarchs were actually flatlined in terms of their gains, while average Americans tripled their real standard of living. But here's what happened in 1970. From about 1970 forward, when the organizing ability of unions in the United States was severely undermined, for a lot of reasons we can't go into, but let's take it my word for it, it was severely undermined, the average earnings of the average American have flatlined essentially since 1970. But for the oligarchs, they have experienced a 15-fold increase in their wealth and concentration, because that's during the period where wealth power took off at exactly the time when participation power and organization was in decline. And it has been a battle that the oligarchs have been winning. And when you mention Citizens United and the judges, one of the things that the Koch brothers and their networks spend a massive amount of money on is judges, appeals judges, Supreme Court judges, judges at all levels, to make sure that the decisions regarding the use of money in the system favor them, to make sure that the decisions of the courts work against workers and unions and class action suits. So they want pro-corporate judges, and they want pro using money in politics judges. And it has been a full court press. The Koch network operates in 36 states in the United States. And it is a finely tuned network. They target candidates both for the ones they support, as well as, and this includes Republicans, if a Republican isn't towing the line, they will threaten to run a primary candidate against that incumbent. And nothing scares an incumbent more than a primary challenge, because very few people participate in primaries, and people like the Koch brothers get a very big bang for the buck that they spend to run a primary candidate against someone. So this is how they get people like Paul Ryan and the other peoples in Congress and at the state level to toe the line. And I frankly must say, these guys have been brilliant, absolutely brilliant, about how they have maximized the impact of their wealth power over the last few decades, but especially in the last 10 years.
And now they're going to target the Republican senator from Nevada, right? The heretic.
That's right. I mean, these are... Here's what's fascinating about this use of wealth power, Ian. It is both blanket in terms of covering the whole system, but it's also laser beam focused, battle by battle, incumbent by incumbent.
Sure.
And you talked about redistricting. You know, one of the things that these guys realized that the Democrats and other progressives didn't realize is that if you could actually use census data and if you could use computer algorithms to draw your districts, you could actually pack all of the progressives and Democrats into just a couple districts and spread Republican majorities over the rest of the districts, and you would actually get you would lock in and maximize a majority in the legislatures, even though, as we saw in the 2016 election, Trump actually lost the popular national vote. Right. And yet, they dominate all the branches. And these guys used their money, and they studied the political system, and they had professors and researchers analyze, and computer technician people analyze, how do we maximize our wealth power against the many and game the system in our favor? And we are living in an era of unprecedented wealth power and its effectiveness.
Well, Jeffrey Winters, I thank you for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure, Ian.
And again, I mean, speak with Jeffrey Winters, who's a professor of political science at Northwestern University, where he specializes in oligarchs and elites, spanning a range of historical and contemporary cases, including ancient Athens and Rome, medieval Europe, the United States, as well as Indonesia, Singapore, Russia, and the Philippines. And he's the author of Oligarchy. Going to take a brief station break. We'll be back exploring further the questions of whether or not we are still a democracy or have become a plutocracy. What have we done? How'd we get so far from the sun? Lost in an oscillating phase where a tiny few catch all of the rays. All of our working days are done, but a tiny few are having all of the fun. Get used to the dust.
I'd like to buy the Cokes a world so they'd leave ours alone, then go back to Park Avenue and crawl beneath their stone.
I'd like to teach the Cokes about a true democracy, where working class takes corporate ass, proceed to
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And on this 4th of July, we're joined by Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz, and previously was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and Chief Economist of the United States Senate Budget Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Johnson.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, Robin. Let me start out with the big question on this patriotic holiday where we celebrate American democracy. Are we still a democracy, or have we become, or are we in danger of becoming a plutocracy?
Oh, I think we're clearly now a plutocracy, where we have a difficult situation in that money can pay for voter suppression. So the spectrum of people who are humans and citizens and Americans is refracted by that process. And our representatives in the Congress, in the Senate, and our president are highly sensitive to the need for money and quite unsensitive to the needs of people. And what I think you can look at the research by the political scientists Martin Gillens and Ben Page, where they separate between the top 10% of the population and their preferences and priorities in surveys and polls, and the bottom 90%, and their evidence is very clear that America only pays attention to the top 10%. So I don't think we are in danger of something happening. I think it has happened, But I do think, in a hopeful sense, that the institutions, the structure, and the tradition, which considers that plutocratic feudalism that we're experiencing unethical and immoral and not the society that we want, is, how would I say, that energy can engage the democratic process and overturn these contorted structures that are deforming our society in a way that can no longer be called a democracy. But we can restore democracy, but it takes a lot of work, a lot of defiance of money and wealth and power. But we saw symptoms of it, ironically, in the Trump campaign and vividly in the Bernie Sanders campaign, and I think we have to press on in that direction.
Well, of course, that is one of the great ironies, that plutocrats, if you will, succeeded in having one of their own. Donald Trump barely won the presidency, and he ran as a populist against the moneyed establishment. But my sense of what's happening now, Rob, is that the fact that the Republicans are having so much trouble with their repeal and replacement of Obamacare would indicate to me that the disconnect is here is that the Congress has essentially been elected by the Koch network. And look what they've passed so far, what the Congress and Trump have done through executive orders and bills. They're essentially rewarding the Koch brothers. This health care repeal and reform is actually a tax cut for the rich. They're waiting to get their big tax reform package through, which will be a massive tax cut for the rich, which they hope to make permanent. Just in terms of the payoff for the Koch brothers, they've opened up offshore drilling. They've brought back coal. They're turning on the tar sands pipeline. They're crippling the EPA, and they're reversing U.S. leadership on climate change. Isn't that what's really happened? Isn't that the real success of this populist president so far?
Well, I think exactly what you say, Ian, is how I say, the unfortunate reality, which is Trump got elected over the Clintons and before that 16 Republicans by outing a plutocratic structure, by talking how the system was rigged, by talking about how it was unrepresentative, by talking about how their despair, as evidenced in diseases like opioid addiction, suicides, sclerosis of the liver related to alcoholism, was pervasive in America. Donald Trump declared the illegitimacy and unrepresentativeness and the failure of the American Republic. So these people felt a sense of hope because somebody finally acknowledged the truth of their experience. But now, out of fears of impeachment, fears related to, which you might call, demonization from the media, fears of weakness, Trump is being driven into the hands, essentially, of the House of Representatives, which is the body in our balance of power that could impeach him. So he's being driven to adopt a more conservative agenda, an agenda that is in contradiction to the promises he made to the people who felt hope again and relief from despair from following his direction and his guidance. And the tax cuts for the 1%, the changes in the nature of health insurance, which makes the health insurance companies more profitable. All of these things are actually quite consistent with evidence that scholars like Tom Ferguson have put forward, which is, where did Trump get his money? If you said to me, what has Trump done since inauguration? What he's done is he's ended the Paris Accord on environmental work, and he's fought very hard to repeal Obamacare. And if you look at who gave him money, you know, he always talks about self-financing that, but he raised over $900 million, largely from the super PACs, the dark money that we talk about. And all the evidence suggests that a lot of that money, very significant proportion, came from insurance companies, came from big banks, came from people in mining and energy people who would want to repeal the Paris Accords and would want free reign vis-a-vis the American population to augment their profits in the insurance industry with relation to health care. So he does look very vividly and very defensively like the creature of the people who bought him, while he complains that the system is rigged.
So I agree. I think you've given us a very, very astute analysis, Rob. But then how do you explain the fact that on election night in Trump Tower, as far as we know, the only two people outside of the Trump family that were there were Peter Thiel, the Silicon Valley libertarian billionaire, and Charles Koch?
Well, I think, as a matter of fact, in large part, Silicon Valley was on the side of the Clintons in that election. But when I look at what this man represents at one level in calling out the staleness and the corruption of the American system, when no one else would do that, it's a condition of hope. It's a vision of hope. But his actions betray his campaign promises, which tells you just how powerful this plutocratic feudalism is. But on the other side, and a lot of people say this to me, people will not abandon Trump, who voted for him, just because Donald Trump contradicted his own campaign analysis and promise that he shared with the American people. What they need is an alternative, because what they felt before Trump was despair. So if they reject Trump, having voted for him, saying, "I was hoodwinked," do they want to jump back into the swimming pool of despair? No. And the real battle right now as to whether Trumpism, not the person, but the whole momentum that we see in this authoritarian and plutocratic momentum that his administration appears to represent, the only way that will be retarded, thwarted, and defeated is if the Democratic Party offers something to a broad base of the American population that is a healthy and credible direction forward. And the dilemma is the Democratic Party is fearful, and not without logic. It is fearful that the possibilities of getting elected without raising $700 million to $1.5 billion as president are very small. So there's a fight going on in the Democratic Party about how to be what you might call the least worst, a little better than Trump, a little less crazy than Trump, but still raising money and pandering to the multinational corporate and financial sectors, or whether they can break free and do something, and like Bernie Sanders, count on what I'll call retail online financing that raised, in his case, $200 to $300 million, and whether that's enough. And I think I know that if a person of that Sanders ilk were elected, it would be a breath of fresh air in a much healthier America. But I don't know, in the structure that's been created by legislation, supported by the Supreme Court with Citizens United and other things, I don't know whether a Democratic Party can succeed when the plutocratic energy in the context of this structure would all migrate to Trump's side for re-election, because they all get their beaks salted in that plutocracy by Trump. But I think what America needs to regain balance, to regain a sense of faith and hope in our nation, is someone as a candidate and a party that takes that bet and goes a different direction. And I don't know if it can happen within the Democratic Party right now. I think there are a whole lot of people that make their money from lobbying. I think there are a whole lot of people that are conditioned on the system of what I'll call plutocratic servitude. And I don't know if we can get there in the current Democratic Party. And therefore, I don't know if a challenge to Donald Trump is viable.
Well, let me just follow up on what you just said, Rob Johnson. The biggest fundraisers for the Hillary Clinton campaign were the Democratic lobbyists such as Ingrid Duran, Vincent Roberti, Steve Elmendorf, Al Mohter, and Ashi Siddiqui. They are all now lobbying on behalf of AT&T and Verizon and Comcast to kill a net neutrality, which Trump's head of the FCC is doing. They're also lobbying on behalf of the private prison industry and others. So isn't this an example of the problem here, of how the money in politics, the lobbyists, you know, the Podestas and others basically play for both teams, and it doesn't matter?
Well, I agree with you entirely. The, how would I say, submission to the plutocratic logic of the current system, the Democratic Party leaders have submitted to, starting in the early 1980s, once again, to cite Tom Ferguson, he and his co-author Joel Rogers wrote a wonderful book in the early 80s called Right Turn, foreshadowing what was coming. And if we continue on the course in the Democratic Party of plutocratic subservience, it is hollow in relation to the needs of the American people. And we won't make any strides forward. And the despondency that we experienced with those who were disappointed from Obama, but he had a soft and more hopeful perspective. But nonetheless, down in the boiler room, things were not happening that needed to happen. And the kind of machinations that you cited, particularly with regard to net neutrality and telecom, but with regard to energy, with regard to financial regulation, with regard to the military industrial complex, with regard to pharmaceuticals, with regard to medical insurance, the Democratic Party has very ugly fingerprints on a lot of things that are oppressing the American people. And it's not because members of the Democratic Party, in my opinion, are morally decrepit, but they are responding to the incentives of a bankrupt system. And the bankruptcy of the system was what Trump called out when he got elected. And unless the Democratic Party finds a way to change the rules, which is hard to do, or finds a way to refute those rules and take the dare of doing something different, we will continue on the same quite discouraging course, which I've called plutocratic feudalism.
Well, Robert Johnson, let's take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment returning to the conversation with Robert Johnson.
You need it, that's for sure.
Democracy is coming to the USA. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And we're continuing the conversation with Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz, and previously was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and Chief Economist of the United States Senate Budget Committee. So just to follow on for what your diagnosis there in terms of the Democrats pivoting to Wall Street, and I take it one of the reasons was that the unions and others, going back to the FDR coalition, were big donors. Not that money was so important back then as it is now, but the unions are now down to about 7% of the private workforce and on the decline. That's the rationale, I guess, for the Clinton, Robert Rubin pivot to Wall Street. But just in general, my critique is not to do with the money, which is definitely, we have, as Tom Ferguson says, you know, it's a money-based system. So psychologically, though, what the problem I have with the Democrats is that they're sort of invested, perhaps even in a delusional way, in the idea that Donald Trump is sort of going to choke on a cheeseburger or get impeached or melt down or walk off in a huff, et cetera, et cetera. I think this guy's got a chance of winning a second term. And, you know, his son-in-law, Jared, has created a relationship with the boy king in Saudi Arabia, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman. They've already given Ivanka $100 million for her foundation, and they're just getting a huge war chest together for 2020. So I think the Democrats have got to psychologically wake up and not count on the other guy on the old platform that they've always run on, is we're better than the other guy.
I think the logic, which I will call the logic of least worst,
right,
has been largely true for the Democratic Party vis-a-vis the population. But when you're the least worst, but your absolute level disintegrates, meaning you're the least worst, but you're horrible, it ceases to matter. And this is what makes the American population vulnerable to demagoguery, to people who create, in the case of Trump, false promises that they will work out of this corner because the system is rigged and so forth. The scary thing is that 16 Republicans and the Clinton family did not acknowledge that the system was rigged, meaning it was working in that plutocratic fashion that you and I have been discussing. It's actually really disparaging to the Democratic Party's reputation that they haven't formed a more formidable rebellion against not only these practices, but these outcomes. That the globalization, so-called, has been a process which has increased the bargaining power of capital, meaning financial capital, corporations, and technology, to the detriment of a large part of the American population, and this is true around the world. It is absolutely dreadful to see, in a period of disruption based on automation and technology or through trade, which has largely been related to the growth of Chinese manufacturing, that nothing is being done in America in the form of trade adjustment assistance, retraining, that were tearing apart the infrastructure of K through 12 education. We're not investing in preschool education. We're ripping apart the public universities that used to be the springboards, the trampolines of social mobility. Places like City University of New York, UCLA in Los Angeles. These places are being turned into money-searching organizations that seek out corporate support so that the corporations can own their laboratories and use these laboratories to create what I'll call subsidized intellectual property rights that they own. We're seeing state universities like Cal Berkeley, UCLA, relying less and less on the state, but still taking 9 or 10% of their money from state taxpayers. But they're diminishing the proportion of people who are residents of the state of California that are allowed to enroll and favoring foreign, what I'll call full tuition-paying applicants. So we've essentially privatized our state universities. We've taken the rungs out of the ladder. We see almost no help emanating from our what I'll call elite Ivy League universities, but even places like University of Michigan, University of Virginia, and Cal Berkeley show almost no evidence of contributing to upward social mobility. So if you have in your life a difficult circumstance or misfortune, you would call it luck or lack of ability, whatever you want to attribute it to, one of the things that created a resilience in American culture was the belief if your child was well-motivated, ethical, moral, hardworking, intense, devoted, they could escape whatever had happened to you in your lifetime. And the danger now is that people can see, and rightly see, based on the evidence, that whatever happens to you, if you have health misfortune that costs you and bankrupts your family, you're actually dooming your children to a much lower level of trajectory in the American system. And this is just not tolerable. This is not something that the Democratic Party is speaking to, and it's not something that anyone will abide in the long term.
Well, but Rob, that's exactly the platform that Bernie Sanders ran on, which
correct.
Was getting out from under student debt, giving our kids some hope. I mean, this is the first time we have a generation that's indentured before it even gets a job. And something has happened, which I think is a total perversion of economic growth and economic priorities, and that is that we are turning our children into centers of profit, not centers of investment.
And this is why people like Noam Chomsky write books titled The Requiem for the American Dream, that the American dream is not something to keep you in the saddle any longer in which you are faithful about the possibilities in America. If you are very fortunate, if you have high levels of wealth, you can insulate your children from, how would I say, this degrading process. But it's only because of wealth, not because of some magnetic energy related to the merit, the potential, and the possibility of those children. And only a child who comes from an immigrant community or a poverty-stricken community who is extraordinary in what they call the STEM disciplines, the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, can go to a place like Caltech or whatever and escape from the bottom to the middle. But the notion of meritocracy, the notion that America now has a meritocracy and therefore the best and the brightest win out is just fraudulent. It's no longer the case. It's alumni children, it's plutocrats' children, it's Russian oligarchs' children who go to our Ivy League schools. And this is demoralizing. This is demoralizing, and it's only going to lead to a much greater degree of social instability, unsustainability, and discord.
Well, just going back to the Bernie Sanders campaign, where these issues not only were brought up by Sanders, but they also clearly resonated and brought out the millennial generation who supported him. And for reasons that absolutely mystify me, Hillary Clinton's people were kind of annoyed at Bernie for upsetting her coronation. The logical thing would have been to make him the vice president. The guy they chose did absolutely nothing for them. And my sense is that the Democratic Party still must be, to some extent, under the influence of Hillary Clinton and her thinking, because they look what they did with this Ossoff guy. They chose a guy, it wasn't even from the district down there in the 6th District in Georgia, and, you know, he ran on a campaign of let's be nice to each other. and facts and figures, all of that stuff that Hillary ran on, where, you know, she gave lists of, she had policies on everything, she had massive position papers, but didn't talk to the people, didn't engage the people in the way that Trump did, even though, you know, you could argue that Trump was kind of, it was sometimes sort of embarrassingly simplistic. But at his rallies, he engages his people, even though if he's making false promises, which it appears to be, he nevertheless, he talks to them and includes them, and even offering his simplistic solutions. But I just can't understand why the party of the people has lost its human touch.
I think the reason they've lost their human touch is because they felt, for their own careers or for their own logic of survival in a plutocratic system, that they needed to have the money touch. And the money touch in a broad-based society, meaning broad economic income and wealth distribution, is not that uncorrelated with the human touch. But in a plutocratic system where 1% of the population or less, 0.1% of the population, drives our politics, drives what we do, no more than 10% of the population has any influence. The idea of having a human touch, the idea of appealing to humans and their needs, is in complete contradiction and tension with subservience and success in that plutocratic system. I'm in a place where when you have people whose own livelihood depends upon the servitude to the plutocratic system for their own well-being, their own children's education, their own belonging. As someone once said to me, the biggest problem with the 1% is percentage 2 through 10 work to serve the 1% in order to belong and get by to the detriment of the other 90. And there's a whole lot of that 2 to 10%, that other group, who are involved in this political process. And recognizing the agenda that Bernie Sanders put forward puts them in contradiction with their own personal well-being and, how would I say, how they are able to perceive the political viability and logic of supporting a Sanders campaign. It didn't show them a way forward where they could be lucrative and successful and their party could win. And so they essentially discredit it, or they work with the DNC and Debbie Wasserman Schultz and others to undermine it, because perhaps before Trump was elected, they had confidence that with the Clinton family, they could have their game and prevail, even if it was like a time bomb, that 8 more years of the Clinton family would create even more despondency and hostility, like NAFTA, criminal justice reform, derivatives deregulation, and the triangulation that the Clinton family represented.
But this sort of the wealth management class of lawyers and accountants, etc., I imagine they could be switched, if you will, in the sense that, well, let me ask you this. There seems to be, when you look at the plutocratic landscape, you've got the Koch brothers on one side and Robert Mercer and others and Rupert Murdoch, who just seem to sort of have unbridled greed and cynicism, I mean, to some extent dressed up in libertarian doctrine. But nevertheless, it seems to be really, Ayn Randian selfishness. And then on the other side,
you cannot separate the allegation of their greediness from their political philosophy.
Right.
I mean, someone can say that earnestly is what they believe.
Right.
But how would I say, doing the right thing and doing better for themselves under that perspective are inseparable.
Right.
So it's very hard to give them credibility. There's no self-sacrifice. There's no sensibility where the people who espouse that are doing something that is to the detriment of their own well-being for the good of society.
But on the other side, you've got Warren Buffett, who once warned that we're in danger of becoming a plantation economy. And, you know, the Microsoft Bill Gates and his father, who's been an advocate for spreading the wealth and economic fairness. Is that what it comes down to? Under this plutocratic system, are we dependent upon the better angels of our plutocrats?
Well, I have an old friend whose name is Doug Carmichael, who lives up in Russian River in California. And when we first met in the spring of 1984, he said, given where America is going, the best thing you can do is pray that rich people have good taste about society's needs. And I've always remembered that. That was just a little quip, but Doug, who's a PhD psychologist and extraordinary in a lot of different respects, he put that out, and at some level, why do we create tax deductibility for plutocrats to be able to do, quote, philanthropy, when they essentially become tax-deductible organizations for these people to create out, to carry out their own policy agendas, and essentially the taxpayer is hearing about how deficits are a problem. We are not spending money on education. We're not spending money on infrastructure. We're not spending money on health. We're not spending money on retirement because we, quote, can't afford it. But we can afford to give deductions to all these billionaires to create political agenda agencies in the philanthropic world who are carrying out what I'll call their personal tastes, their own ideas as architects of society. Why should that be subsidized? I think it's, I work obviously with the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and George Soros has been a big backer. The same question applies to him. At some level, why are not Warren Buffett, George Soros, Bill Gates, many of the Google partners and others advocating for an end to the tax deductibility of philanthropic organizations? Why are they not advocating for removing the money in politics dimensions, which they all benefit from because they have so much money? I mean, they spend a lot of money on it, but why is anybody abiding by this unhealthy system?
Well, Robert Johnson, I have to leave you there. We've run out of time on this 4th of July. But I'm very grateful for your time and for your insight, and I thank you for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's always nice to talk with you, Ian, and how would I say, I hope you and your listeners keep driving at these issues. The time is very urgent now, and I appreciate the work that you do.
Well, thank you, Rob. And again, I've been speaking with Rob Johnson, who's the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz, and previously was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and Chief Economist of the United States Senate Budget Committee. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and Clemence Penard. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.